You're listening to Paranormal Portal on Revolver Podcasts. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to our edition tonight of the Paranormal Portal. Got a special episode wound up for you tonight. This one should be a good one. This is a classic, but it's an amazing tale. The stories of Sasquatch, oftentimes we're stuck with, I saw it go across the road, or it was standing next to the house, or it's these little glimpses and these momentary occurrences where one of these beings happens to be seen. And then every once in a while, we get a story with some depth and substance that is purported to be a true account of actually spending time with the Sasquatch. And tonight is no exception. So tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to discuss the Albert Osman story. Now, this is going to be one story for the whole evening. It's a long story, but I think it's a brilliant story. Is it true? Is it not true? Honestly, I can't tell you. I don't know. I know there's some controversy out there about it, but as far as I know, he swears until the day he died that this account was accurate. This account happens in 1924, so it's quite old, but it kind of is a time when the wildernesses really were very much untamed. So let's just see what you guys think. If you haven't heard of this story before, you're in for a great treat, but if you have heard it, then just relax while we relive a classic. So let's see what this story has in store for you guys. Always followed logging and construction work, and this time I had worked over a year on a construction job and thought that a good vacation was in order. British Columbia is famous for lost gold mines. One is supposed to be at the head of the Toba Inlet, and why not look for this mine and have a vacation at the same time? I took the Union steamship boat to Lund, British Columbia, and from there I hired an old Indian to take me up to the head of the Toba Inlet. This old Indian was a very talkative old gentleman, and he told me stories about gold brought out by a white man from his lost mine, and this white man was a very heavy drinker, spent his money freely in saloons, but he had no trouble getting more money. He would always be away just for a few days, then come back with a bag of gold. But one time he went to his mine and just never came back, and people said a Sasquatch had killed him. At that time, I never heard of a Sasquatch, so I asked what kind of animal he called a Sasquatch, and the Indian said they have hair all over their bodies. But they aren't animals. They are people. Big people living in the mountains. My uncle saw the tracks of one that were 2 feet long. One old Indian saw one over 8 feet tall. I told the Indian I didn't believe in their old fables about mountain giants. It might have been some thousands of years ago, but not nowadays. The Indian said, well, there may not be many, but they still exist. We arrived at the head of the inlet at about 4 p.m., and I made camp at the mouth of the creek. And the Indian had supped with me, and I told him to look out for me in about 3 weeks, and I'd be camping at the same spot when I came back. The next morning, I took my rifle with me, but left my equipment at the camp, and I decided to look around for some deer trail to lead me into the mountains. And on the way up the inlet, I'd seen a pass in the mountain that I wanted to go through to see what was on the other side. I spent most of the forenoon looking for a trail, but found none except for a hogback running down to the beach. So I swamped out a trail from there and got to my camp at about 3 p.m. that afternoon and made up my pack to be ready in the morning. And my equipment consisted of one 30-30 Winchester rifle, and I had a special homemade prospecting pack, or pick, rather, axe on one end and pick on the other. I had a leather case for this pick, which fastened my belt, also my sheath knife, and my storekeeper at Lund was cooperative, and he gave me some cans for my sugar and salt and matches to keep them dry, and my grub consisted mostly of canned stuff, except for a side of bacon, a bag of beans, 4 pounds of prunes, and 6 packets of macaroni, cheese, 3 pounds of pancake flour, and 6 packets of Rye King hardtack. 3 rolls of snuff, 1/4 seal of butter, and 2 1-pound cans of milk. I had 2 boxes of shells for my rifle. The storekeeper gave me a biscuit tin, and I put a few things in that and cached it under a windfall, so I would have it when I came back here waiting for a boat to bring me out. My sleeping bag I rolled up and tied on top of my pack sack, and together with my ground sheet, small frying pan, and 1 aluminum pot that held about 1 gallon, as my canned food was used, I would get plenty of empty cans to cook with. The following morning, I had an early breakfast, made up my pack, and started out for this hogback. My pack must have been at least 80 pounds, besides my rifle. After 1 hour, I had to rest. I kept resting and climbing all that morning, and at about 2 p.m., I came to a flat place below a rock bluff, and there was a bunch of willow in one place, and I made a wooden spade and started digging for water, and about 1 foot down, I got seepings of water. So I decided to camp here for the night and scout around for the best way to get on from here. Must have been up to near 1,000 feet, and there was a most beautiful view over the islands and the strait and tugboats with log booms and fishing boats going in all directions, just a lovely spot. I spent the following day prospecting around, but I saw no signs of minerals. I found a deer trail leading towards this pass that I had seen on my way up the inlet. And the following morning, I started out early while it was still cool, and I was steep climbing with my heavy pack. And after a 3 hours climb, I was tired and stopped to rest. And on the other side of a ravine from where I was resting was a yellow spot below some small trees. And I moved over there and started digging for water. I found a small spring and made a small trough from cedar bark and got a small amount of water and had my lunch and rested there till evening. I made it over the pass late that night. Now, I had downhill and good going, but I was hungry and tired, so I camped at the first bunch of trees I came to, and I was trying to size up the terrain, what direction I would take from here. Towards the west would lead me to lowland and some other inlets, so I decided to go in a northeast direction. Had good going and a slight downhill all day. I must have made 10 miles when I came to a small spring and with a big black hemlock tree. What a lovely campsite. I spent 2 days here, just resting and prospecting, and the first night here, I shot a small deer. 2 days later, I found an exceptionally good campsite, and it was two good-sized cypress trees growing close together and near a rock wall with a nice spring just below these trees. I intended to make this my permanent camp, and I cut a lot of brush and for my bed between these trees, and I rigged up a pole from this rock wall to hang my pack sack on, and I arranged some flat rocks for my fireplace for cooking, and had a really classy setup. And that is when things began to happen. I'm a heavy sleeper. Not much disturbs me after I go to sleep, especially on a good bed like I had now. Next morning, I noticed things had been disturbed during the night, but nothing missing that I could see. I roasted my grouse on a stick for breakfast, and that night I filled up the magazine of my rifle, and I still had one box of 20 shells and 6 shells in my coat pocket, and that night I laid my rifle under the edge of my sleeping bag, and I thought a porcupine had visited me the night before, and porkies like leather, so I put my shoes up in the bottom of my sleeping bag. The next morning, my pack sack had been emptied out. Someone had turned the sack upside down, but it was still hanging on the pole from the shoulder straps as I had hung it up. Then I noticed that 1 half-pound package of prunes was missing. Also, my pancake flour was missing, but my salt bag was not touched. Porkies always look for salt, so I decided it must be something else than porkies. I looked for tracks, but found nothing. I didn't think it was a bear. They always tear up things and make a mess, and I kept close to camp these days in case this visitor would come back. I climbed up on a big rock where I had a good view of the camp, but nothing showed up. I was hoping it would be a porky, so I'd get a good porky stew, but these visits had now been going on for 3 nights. This night it was cloudy, and it looked like it might be rain. I took special notice of how everything was arranged, and I closed my pack sack. I didn't undress. I only took off my shoes and put them in the bottom of my sleeping bag. I drove my prospecting pick into one of the cypress trees so I could reach it from my bed, and I also put the rifle alongside me inside my sleeping bag, and I fully intended to stay awake all night to find out who my visitor was, but I must have fallen asleep. I was awakened by something picking me up. I was half asleep, and at first I didn't remember where I was. And as I began to get my wits together, I remembered I was on this prospecting trip and in my sleeping bag. My first thought was it must be a snow slide, but there was no snow anywhere around my camp. Then it felt like I was tossed on a horseback, but I could feel whoever it was walking. I tried to reason out what kind of animal this could be, and I tried to get all my sheath knife and cut my way out, but I was in an almost sitting position, and the knife was under me, and I couldn't get a hold of it. But the rifle was in front of me. I had a good hold on that, but no intention to let go of it. At times, I could feel my pack sack touching me, and I could feel the cans in the sack touching my back. After what felt like an hour, I could feel like we were going up a steep hill, and I could feel myself rise for every step. What was carrying me was breathing hard and sometimes gave a slight cough. Now I knew this must be one of the mountain Sasquatch giants the Indian told me about. I was in a very uncomfortable position, unable to move. I was sitting on my feet, and one of my boots in the bottom of the bag was crossways with the hobnail sole up across my foot. It hurt terrible, but I couldn't move. It was very hot outside, and I was lucky for me this fellow's hand was not big enough to close up the whole bag, and when he picked me up, and there was a small opening at the top, otherwise I think I would have choked to death. Now he was going downhill, and I could feel myself touching the ground at times, and at one time he dragged me behind him, and I could feel he was below me. Then he seemed to get on level ground and was going at a trot for a long time. This time I had cramps in my legs, and the pain was terrible. I was wishing he would get to this destination soon. I couldn't stand this type of transportation much longer. Now he was going uphill again, and it did not hurt me so bad, and I tried to estimate distance and directions as near as I could guess. We were about 3 miles traveling, and I had no idea when he started, as I was asleep when he picked me up. Finally, he stopped, and he let me down. Then he dropped my pack sack, and I could hear the cans rattling. Then I heard clatter, chatter, some kind of talk I didn't understand. The ground was sloping, so when he let go of my sleeping bag, I rolled downhill, and I got my head out and got some air. I tried to straighten my legs and crawl out, but my legs were absolutely numb. It was still dark, and I couldn't see what my captors looked like. I tried to massage my legs to get some life in them, but and get my shoes on, And I could hear now it was at least four of them, and they were standing around me and continuously chattering. I had never heard of Sasquatch before the Indian told me about them, but I knew I was right among them. But how to get away from them? That was another question. I got to see the outline of them now, and as it began to get a little lighter, though the sky was cloudy and it looked like rain, in fact, there was a slight sprinkle. I now had circulation in my legs, but my left foot was very sore on top of where it had been rested on my hobnail boots, and I got my boots out from the sleeping bag and tried to stand up, and I found that I was wobbly on my feet, but I had a good hold of my rifle. I asked, "What do you fellows want with me?" Only some more chatter. It was getting lighter now, and I could see them quite clearly. I could make out forms of four people, two big and two little ones, and they were all covered with hair and no clothes on at all. I could now make out the mountains all around me, and I looked at my watch, and it was 4:25 a.m. It was getting lighter now, and I could see the people clearly. They looked like a family. Old man, old lady, two young ones, a boy and a girl, and the boy and the girl seemed to be really scared of me. The old lady didn't seem too pleased about what the old man had dragged me home, but the old man was waving his arms and telling them all what he had in mind. They all left me then. I had my compass and my prospecting glass on strings around my neck, and the compass was in my left-hand shirt pocket and my glass in my right-hand pocket, and I tried to reason our location. And where I was, I could see now that I was in a small valley or basin, about 8 or 10 acres, surrounded by high mountains on the southeast side. There was a V-shaped opening about 8 feet wide at the bottom and about 20 feet high in the highest point. That must be the way we came in, but how will I get out? The old man was now sitting right near this opening. I moved my belongings up close to the west wall, and there were two small cypress trees there, and this will do for a shelter for the time being until I find out what these people want with me and how to get away from here. I emptied out my pack sack to see what I had left in the line of food, and all my canned meat and vegetables were intact, and I had one can of coffee and three small cans of milk. The packages of rye, king hardtack, and my butter sealer half full of butter, but my prunes and macaroni were missing. Also my full box of shells for my rifle. I had my sheath knife, but my prospecting pick was missing, and my can of matches. I only had my safety box full, and that only held about a dozen matches. That didn't worry me. I can always start a fire with my prospecting glass when the sun is shining. If I got dry wood, I could do it. I wanted hot coffee, but I had no wood, and also nothing around here that looked like wood. I had a good look over at the valley from where I was, but the boy and girl were always watching me from behind some juniper bush and decided that there must be some water around here. The ground was leaning towards the opening in the wall, and there must be water at the upper end of this valley. There's green grass and moss along the bottom, so all my utensils were left behind. I opened my coffee tin and emptied the coffee in a dish towel and tied it with a metal strip from the can, and I took my rifle and the can and went looking for water. Right at the head, under the cliff, there was a lovely spring that disappeared underground. I got a drink and a can full of water, and when I got back, the young boy was looking over my belongings. He didn't touch anything, but on my way back, I noticed that where these people were sleeping. On the east side of the wall of this valley was a shelf in the mountainside, with overhanging rock looking something like a big undercut, in a big tree about 10 feet deep and 30 feet wide. The floor was covered with lots of dry moss, and they had some kind of blankets woven of narrow strips of cedar bark, packed with dry moss. They looked very practical and warm, with no need of washing. The first day, not much happened. I had to eat my food cold, and the young fellow was coming nearer me and seemed curious about me. My one box of snuff was empty, so I relied it toward him. I don't know what that means. I rallied it or relied? I don't know. And then when he saw it coming, he sprang up quick as a cat and grabbed it. He He went over to his sister and showed her. They found out how to open and close it, and they spent a long time playing with it. Then he trotted over to the old man and showed him, and they had a long chatter. Next morning, I made up my mind to leave this place. If I had to shoot my way out, I would. I couldn't stay that much longer. I only had enough grub to last me till I got back to the Toba Inlet, and I didn't know that direction, but I would go downhill, and I would come out near civilization someplace. I rolled up my sleeping bag, put that inside of my pack sack, packed the few cans that I had, and swung the sack on my back, injected the shell into the barrel of my rifle, and started for the opening in the wall. The old man got up and held his hands as though he would push me back. I pointed to the opening. I wanted to go out. But he stood there pushing me and said something that sounded like, "Soka, Soka." I backed up about 60 feet. I didn't want to be too close. I thought if I had to shoot my way out, a 30-30 might not have much effect on this fella. It might make him mad, and I only had 6 shells, so I decided to wait. There must be a better way than killing him in order to get out from there. I went back to my campsite to figure out some other way to get out, and I could make friends with the young fellow or the girl. They might help me. If only I could talk to them. Then I thought of a fellow who saved himself from a mad bull by blinding him with snuff in his eyes. But how will I get near enough to this fellow to put snuff in his eyes? So I decided next time I give the young fellow my snuff box to leave a few grains of snuff in it, and he might give the old man a taste of it. But the question is, in what direction will I go? If I should get out, I must have been about 25 miles northwest of Toba Inlet, where I was kidnapped, and this fellow must have traveled at least 25 miles in the 3 hours he carried me. And if he went west, I'd be near the salt water, and same thing if I went south. Therefore, he must have gone northeast. If I then keep going south and over 2 mountains, I must hit salt water, someplace between London and Vancouver. All right, guys, this is probably a great place for us to take a break, so don't go away, everybody. Hey, guys, Brent Thomas here of the Paranormal Portal Podcast. We just wanted to take a moment to introduce you to the Paranormal Portal store. We've got t-shirts, hoodies, leggings, stickers, mugs, you name it, you might find it over there. So head on over to teespring.com/stores/paranormal-portal, and you too can help fund the Paranormal Portal podcast. Thank you so much for all that you do, and thank you for being a part of our Paranormal Portal family. Following day, I didn't see the old lady till about 4 p.m. She came home with her arms full of grass and twigs and all kinds of spruce and hemlock, as well as some kind of nuts that will grow in the ground, and I've seen lots of them on Vancouver Island. The young fellow went up the mountain on the east every day. He could climb better than a mountain goat, and he picked some kind of grass with long, sweet roots, and he gave me some one day, and they tasted very sweet. I gave him another snuff box with about a teaspoon of snuff in it, and he tasted it and then went to the old man, and he licked it with his tongue, and they had a long chat, and I made a dipper from a milk can, and I made many dippers. You can use them for pots, too. You cut 2 slits near the top of any can, and then cut a limb from any small tree, and cut down back of the limb down the stem of the tree. And then taper the part you cut from the stem. Then cut a hole in the tapered part. Slide the tapered part in the slit, and you've made in the can, and you have a good handle on your can. I threw one over to the young fellow that was playing near my camp, and he picked it up and looked at it, and then went to the old man and showed it to him. They had a long chatter, and then he came to me, pointed at the dipper, then at his sister, and I could see that he wanted one for her too. I had other peas and carrots, so I made one for his sister, and he was standing only 8 feet away from me, and when I had made the dipper, I dipped it in water and drank from it, and he was very pleased and almost smiled at me. Then I took a chew of snuff and smacked my lips and said, "That's good." The young fellow pointed at the old man and said something like, "Ook." I got the idea that the old man liked snuff, and the young fellow wanted a box for the old man, and I shook my head, and I motioned my hands for the old man to come to me. I don't think the young fellow understood what I meant, and he went to his sister and gave her the dipper I made for her. They didn't come near me again that day. I'd now been here 6 days, but I was sure I was making progress. If only I could get the old man to come over to me and get him to eat a full box of the snuff, and that would kill him for sure. And that way kill himself, I wouldn't be guilty of murder. The old lady was a meek old thing, and the young fellow was by this time quite friendly. The girl would not hurt anybody. Her chest was flat like a boy's, no development like young ladies. And I'm sure if I could get the old man out of the way, I could easily have brought this girl out with me to civilization, but what good would that have been? I'd have to keep her in a cage for public display, and I didn't think we have any right to force our way of life on other people. And I don't think they'd like it. The noise and racket in a modern city wouldn't like that any more than I do. The young fellow might have been between 11 and 18 years old, about 7 feet tall, and might weigh about 300 pounds. His chest would be 50 to 55 inches, his waist was about 36 to 38 inches, and he had wide jaws and narrow forehead that slanted upward round the back about 4 or 5 inches higher than the forehead. The hair on their heads was about 6 inches long, and the hair on the rest of their bodies was short and thick in places, and the women's hair on the forehead had an upward turn like some women have, and they call it bangs among women's hairdos, and nowadays the old lady could have been anything between 40 to 70 years old. She was over 7 feet tall, and she would be about 500 to 600 pounds. She had very wide hips and a goose-like walk. She was not built for beauty or speed. Some of these lovable brassiers and uplifts would have been a great improvement on her looks and her figure. The man's eye teeth were longer than the rest of the teeth, but not long enough to be called tusks. The old man must have been near 8 feet tall, big barrel chest, big hump on his back, powerful shoulders. His biceps on his upper arm were enormous and tapered down to his elbows. His forearms were longer than common people have, but well proportioned. His hands were wide, and the palm was long and broad and hollow like a scoop. His fingers were short in proportion to the rest of his hand. His fingernails were like chisels. The only place they had no hair was inside their hands and on the soles of their feet and the upper part of the nose and eyelids. I never did see any ears. They were covered with hair and hanging over them. If the old man were to wear a collar, it would have been at least 30 inches. I have no idea what size shoes they would need, but I was watching the young fellow's foot one day when he was sitting down, and the soles of his feet seemed to be padded like a dog's foot, and the big toe was longer than the rest and very strong. In mountain climbing, all he needed for footing was his big toe, and they were very agile. To sit down, they turned their knees out and came straight down. To rise up straight up without the helps of hands or arms. And I don't think this valley was a permanent home. I think they moved from place to place, as food is available in different localities. They might eat meat, but I never saw them eat meat or do any cooking. I think this was probably a stopover place, with the plants with sweet roots and the mountainside might have been in season this time of year, and they seem to be most interested in them, and the roots have a very sweet and satisfying taste. They always seemed to do everything for a reason, wasted no time on anything they didn't need. When they weren't looking for food, the old man and the old lady were resting, but the boy and the girl were always climbing something or some other exercise. A favorite position was to take hold of his feet with his hands and balance on his rump, and then bounce forward. The idea seems to be to see how far he could go without his feet or hands touching the ground. Sometimes he made a good 20 feet. What do they want with me? They must understand I can't stay here indefinitely. I will soon have to make a break for freedom. Not that I was mistreated in any way. One consolation was that the old man was coming closer and closer each day, and was very interested in my snuff. Watching me when I take a pinch of snuff, he seems to think it useless to only put it inside my lips. One morning after I had my breakfast, both the old man and boy came and sat down only 10 feet away from me. This morning I made coffee, and I had saved all the dry branches I found, and I had some dry moss, and I used all the labels from the cans to start a fire. I got my coffee pot boiling, and it was strong coffee, too, and the aroma from boiling coffee is what brought them over. I was sitting eating hardtack with plenty of butter on it, sipping coffee, and it sure tasted good. I was smacking my lips, pretending it was better than it really was. And I set the can down that was about half full, and I intended to warm it up later, and I pulled out a full box of snuff and took a big chew. Before I had time to close the box lid, the old man reached for it, and I was afraid he'd waste it. And only had two more boxes, so I held the box, intending him to take a pinch, like I had just done. Instead, he grabbed the box and emptied it in his mouth, swallowed it in one gulp. Then he licked the box inside with his tongue. Yeesh. After a few moments, his eyes began to roll over in his head, and he was looking straight up, and I could see he was sick. Then he grabbed my coffee can that was quite cold by this time and emptied that in his mouth, grounds and all. That did no good. He stuck his head between his legs and rolled forward a few times away from me. Then he began to squeal like a stuck pig, and I grabbed my rifle and I said to myself, "This is it. If he comes for me, I'll shoot him plumb between the eyes." But he started for the spring, and he wanted water, and I packed my sleeping bag and my pack sack with a few cans I had left, and the young fellow ran over to his mother, and she began to squeal, and I started for the opening in the wall, and I just made it. The old lady was right behind me. I fired one shot at the rock above her head. I guess she had never seen a rifle fired before. She turned and ran inside the wall. I injected another shell into the barrel of my rifle and started downhill, looking back over my shoulder every so often to see if they were coming. I was in a canyon and good at traveling, and I made fast time. Must have made 3 miles in some world record time. I came to a turn in the canyon, and I had the sun on my left, and that meant I was going south, and the canyon turned west. I decided to climb the ridge ahead of me, and I knew that I must have two canyon ridges between me and salt water, and by climbing this ridge, I'd have a good view of this canyon so I could see if the Sasquatch were coming after me. I had a light pack and was making good time up this hill, and I stopped soon after to look back to where I came from, but nobody followed me. As I came over the ridge, I could see Mount Baker, and I knew I was going in the right direction. I was hungry and tired, and I opened my pack sack to see what I had to eat, and I decided to rest here for a while, and I had a good view of the mountainside, and if the old man was coming, I had the advantage because I was up above him. To get me, he'd have to come up like a steep hill, and that might not be so easy after stopping a few 30-30 bullets. I had made up my mind that this was my last chance, and this would be a fight to the finish. I rested here for 2 hours, and it was 3 p.m., when I started down the mountainside, it was nice going, not too steep, not too much underbrush. When I got near the bottom, I shot a blue grouse. She was sitting on a windfall, looking right at me, only 100 feet away. I shot her neck right off. I made it down the creek at the bottom of this canyon, and I felt I was safe now. I made a fire between two big boulders, roasted the grouse, and next morning when I woke up, I was feeling terrible. My feet were sore from dirty socks. My legs were sore, my stomach was upset from that grouse that I ate the night before. I was not too sure I was going to make it up that mountain. I finally made the top, but it took me 6 hours to get there. It was cloudy, visibility about a mile, and I knew I had to go downhill. After about 2 hours, I got down to heavy timber and sat down to rest, and I could hear a mortar running hard at times and then stop. I listened to this for a while and decided the sound was from a gas donkey. Someone was logging in the neighborhood. I told them I was a prospector and was lost, and I did not like to tell them that I'd been kidnapped by a Sasquatch. As if I had told them, they probably would have said he's crazy too. The following day, I went down from this camp to, on Salmon Arm Branch to Sechelt Inlet. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And from there, I got the Union boat back to Vancouver. That was my last prospecting trip and my only experience with what is known as Sasquatches. I know that in 1924, there were four Sasquatches living. It might be only two now. The old man and old lady might be dead by this time. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is his story. Now, yeah, I find it, this is one of the first historical stories I ever read after I became interested in Sasquatch. And I find it really, I don't know. I don't see anything. I mean, it's a fantastical tale. I'll grant you that. I mean, it's might seem hard to believe that they would have kidnapped him and brought him to their home and dumped him out there. But as far as I know, it was something he swore to until the day he died. Now there's some controversial claims that people have made that, he finally came clean that it wasn't true, but I have not heard that. I've not seen that. And as far as a good friend of his says, even up to the day he died, he claimed he swore that this was a true account. So then the interesting thing is it does show a behavior. It shows several behaviors. It shows the family structure. It shows their curiosity. It shows their social engagements, that they have a language. All of these things predate the Sierra sounds. They predate so many other things. It predates the term Bigfoot by a long time. Remember, this is 1924. The term Bigfoot didn't come out until the 50s. So, and that was from a logging camp in California, I believe. There were big tracks, and I think a newspaper man called the Bigfoot because it was such a huge track. The insights that are in this don't seem all that different from a lot of different ones that we've heard. What we've heard from other investigators, and I know Shel Dion has had experience with these Sasquatch as well, and has had firsthand knowledge of them. You know, it's really interesting, and ladies and gentlemen, we'll be having Mr. Kevin Lang on the show, and he's had a up close and personal relationship with a young Sasquatch that he befriended when he was a kid, named Glagg, GLAGG, and he'll be on the show to share his experiences and knowledge and insights into what he's experienced. But if you want to hear some of his stories and some of what he's experienced, be sure to check out World Bigfoot Radio's YouTube channel. That's Duke's YouTube channel. And he did like seven shows with Kevin regarding his experiences with Glagg. And the emotion that he has in sharing these stories of his good friend. I mean, he refers to the Sasquatch as his good friend. It was like his only friend growing up. And they just seems like they had this really neat, strong bond. And while they did seem to drift apart, when this Glagg took a mate and things changed, which stands to reason, but just some neat opportunities that people have had to have firsthand knowledge of these beings. And I don't want to say creatures, because I don't think they are creatures. I think they are, they are an intelligent being, but it's just, they're so different from us that it's hard for us. We have a tendency to want to view things as animals. They are animals. They are apes. Because that way we can dismiss them. We can still remain on top of the pile. Like we're Homo sapiens. We are men and women, and we are people. And, I don't think that you can dismiss these things as just creatures, as just these apes, you know, these mindless things, not mindless, but you know what I'm saying? That I think as these encounters happen, and as we hear about encounters like the one I just shared with you, you get an insight into the structure and the thinking and the sense of community these things have, and you develop a new appreciation. They're not just these machines that go out and, you know, chase down deer and herd people off of the land. They are thinking, they are protective, they are, for the most part, choose a secluded life away from us. And that's probably why they're still around today, is that they've chosen our absence. So just some thoughts, but I just love this story. This is, after I read this the first time, I was just like, wow. You know, it was like having a window into a world we've only imagined. Most people are just happy to see prints or, you know, grab some hairs stuck on a barbed wire fence or something. But this gentleman allegedly had the experience of spending time with them, not by choice. I still don't know why they would have grabbed him. What was the end game on that? I don't know. Did they just want him there to learn something about these people that were appearing in the forests and logging and stuff? Was that their way of understanding this new emergence of people logging and fishing and being in their, you know, what was otherwise a very secluded world? You know, and that's the only thing that makes sense to me, is they just wanted an opportunity to see what are these people. And so they came across this one guy alone who happened to be a heavy sleeper tucked into a sleeping bag. So it's like, yeah, that's what makes sense to me. I mean, clearly he wasn't going to be food that I know of. I don't think he was going to ever be food, because he wouldn't have been left to interact and stuff. They would have just disabled him. And, you know, there are stories of the way these beings hunt. Yeah, they are known to, like in the skunk apes in Florida, are known to, you know, herd up hogs and then break their legs and then leave. And when they need the food, they come back and find this injured hog, and then they'll take them out and eat them. So I don't think this Albert Ostman was ever going to be food. It just seems that it was an act of curiosity. And I think that also shows intelligence. Don't think it turned out real well for him eating the whole box of snuff, but whatever the case, I don't know. I hope you guys liked that, though. I hope you guys enjoyed that story. Again, it's one of my favorites, and it's the first story that I ever came across in my research that showed a different side to these beings and showed a compassionate, intelligent, amazing being that exists away from us. Okay, cool. Thank you, lady. I'm glad to know. I don't know how many of you had already heard of this story. Maybe you've heard a reference of it. Maybe you've heard the whole story before, but I just think it's a classic. It's really something. And when these things happen, oh, thank you. I appreciate that, Gemini. At the very least, it's a possibility. And the portal is always going to be a discussion of possibilities. And this is another possibility. This is a window into an idea that maybe they're more than just these hairy things running through the woods, procreating and dragging down deer and spooking hunters, and you know, harassing people from time to time because they're bored. It shows a structure and a community and really cool insights. So I think that's going to about wrap it up tonight. Again, please subscribe if you're hearing this broadcast. We are definitely growing, and it's just really cool to see our family of Paranormal Portal people growing as well. I guess that's about it. Be good, be kind, be nice, and make sure you take care of each other out there. I love you guys, and have a good night.
sports betting is sweeping across the country faster than the coronavirus, and Wagering Week is your antidote. I'm Tom Martin, and I'm a veteran sports analyst and respected sports handicapper who helped build ESPN's brand. I've been recognized and awarded by Pro Football Weekly and Gaming Today magazine as the honest handicapper. Let the other guys give you the same old boring sports talk with the same tired storylines. We'll give it to you straight here every Friday on Wagering Week. Don't gamble with other podcasts. Let Sports Garden Network's Wagering Week help your bottom line.